Hello. Just a little bit of housekeeping, first of all. So the Live Comedy Association, I was the England South representative of the Live Comedy Association for 7 months during the pandemic. And we set up probably the most comprehensive nationwide survey of the comedy industry, and then set up a Save Live Comedy campaign, which got loads of traction, was like number one hashtag for 24 hours, I think, on Twitter. And now they've set up a Save Live Comedy fund with the brilliant Next Up Comedy, who are always very generous with giving me bits of work. And the fund is supporting those most in need across the industry. With your help, they can make sure that nobody is forced out of the comedy industry. So they're already you can donate at savelivecomedy.co.uk. They're already over halfway to their target, which is £50,000. And they, in this second survey that they've launched, here's some of the sort of damning statistics that they've got. 50% of people in comedy industries, that's comedians, any kind of comedy operator, really, producers, tech people, they've given serious thought to leaving the comedy industry because of the pandemic. 81% of the industry say their mental health has been negatively impacted by job uncertainty. 50% of the comedy industry has lost over half their annual income since the beginning of the pandemic. And this fund will be for people who've kind of fallen through every economic safety net, including UC, Universal Credit. They haven't been eligible for that. So savelivecomedy.co.uk, any bits of, you've got any disposable income, any shekels you can send their way, please consider it, because it's a robust industry that provides a lot of much needed levity and fun for people in the UK and all over the world. But I mean, we're talking about the UK industry here. And it's an industry that pumps in a lot more revenue than extracts from the national purse, because the overheads are so small. Like, you could set up in a rough space, the Peter Brook idea of a rough space and a pub back room. They've already got a microphone, they've already got a PA system, so the overheads are nil. And I used to run just a micro example of that. I used to run a professional comedy night in Southend called Pints, full stop. And we, in the pub, the Railway Pub, it's been there since like Georgian times or something. It still retains some of the decor from like Victorian times. I don't know the chronology. Anyway, and Thursday evenings, they wouldn't have many punters in. They wouldn't get much custom. I started doing a monthly comedy night, and on that night, they, you know, they'd had quite a big influx of punters coming in and buying booze and enjoying the comedy. So that's what we can do for you on a national scale. So yeah, if you wouldn't mind, I mean, this is all I've got, and I have got to. I mean, a lot of us are already feeling vulnerable. Where are we in this kind of the socioeconomic hierarchy? Where's our sense? Where can we direct this sense of this thing that we enables us to achieve a sense of self-esteem? Where else can we get that? But comedy is my life. Writing is my life. I've got to make a go of one of those things, because there's not much else. I have no skills in. Oh, I used to paint. I used to sell paintings and stuff. You sell paintings. But yeah, other than that, nothing. Got nothing. I need to. We're all very needy, maladapted people in comedy. There's actually a a survey recently where it said it's a woman who actually wasn't a survey, that's just a nickname for one woman who happened to have slept with lots of different people. And she said comedians are the worst people to have sex with because they're desperate for validation, which comes as no surprise. Because comedians are the worst in bed. Comedians have been dubbed the worst type of celebrities to spend the night with. That's according to a woman who had more than 20 starry encounters. Comes as no surprise. So today we're going to be talking about vulnerability. As a lover, I am... what I'm like as a socializer. I'm gregarious in very short bursts. It's quite a time sensitive, fraught interaction. And with having sex, because I get puffed out and bored quite easily. And I've also got a huge complex around sex because with my ex, if she didn't achieve orgasm, she would get a little bit fighty. She'd get a little bit fighty. And so now, I used to finish myself off all the time, pretty much do every time I have sex. I have to finish myself off, but I feel like I have to try and finish them off. This is such an awful way. I'm talking about it in quite an Anglo-Saxon colloquial way because I don't know how else to discuss it really. There's also something about it that stinks. That's impure. I don't know. I wasn't raised in a religious household or anything like that, so I don't know I don't know where that's come from. But I enjoy it, but not always. And I feel very nervous. I feel like bad things will happen if I don't make them climax. And then that can obviously lead to overcompensation, I suppose. Just rubbing away at it like a scratch and sniff. Rubbing away at it. Just go, bling, boing, boing, boing. Yeah, just... Oh. Are you done yet? Tugging at the clitoris as if you're trying to get a butler's attention. I was thinking of like a bell, really. I suppose you tug at a rope, don't you? But it was more, I don't know. I've got a contraption in my mind, but I don't know what that contraption is. But for some reason, I've made a logical leap that it's something you use to get the butler's attention. But yeah, So I don't know as well. It's like a mental block where I can't finish inside another person. Maybe it's because I rarely use condoms. Again, that's not my decision. It's a mutual decision. And maybe I'm worried about pregnancy or something. I don't know. I'm not promoting good sexual health here. This is like a... I've got hang-ups with sex because I'm worried of getting bitten punched. I'm worried of someone. Oh, yes, I'm worried of. Yeah, always. I think they're gonna ingest me like a praying mantis afterwards. Smash me over the head with their jewellery box, or passive aggressively hoover at 3 a.m. So today we're going to be talking about the ethics of vulnerability. I think I've, is that a good segue into it? I suppose so, yes. I feel very, very vulnerable. I'm not a sexually confident person. Don't think I project sexuality either. There's some, a few people before said, oh, like they said there's a eunuch quality to me. I'm like, yeah, I fuck, boy. I just don't feel the need to. I just don't. Why? You can project sexuality if you're confident enough in your body to be able to do that. I have gone through moments where I felt that way when I was like tanned, I'd lost a lot of weight, I became quite toned, but even then I was I still wasn't, I look back at some of them pictures and think, like, why wasn't you making the most of that? Like, you looked good, you would have got a bit of attention, and I've never had a period in my life where I was like really, like I was a Lothario or anything like that. Not at all. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's something that'll come with you. You can become more confident in your body as you get older. Like, I'm fat now. I'm a fat lad, but I hold it well. I don't feel too insecure or bent out of shape. I mean, like, physically I am bent out of shape because of the belly, the body. You get lumps and bumps, you're the shape of you is bent outwards, but I don't have any kind of insecurities that are detrimental to my social self, that actually stopped me from having a social self, because I end up holing up indoors. So yeah, I've got to talk about vulnerability. There's a few things I've I got thinking about this. So I wrote about someone that I used to work with, and there's a kind of way I described this person. I'll just get to it. So she's plump with pale skin and very short blonde hair. I actually said very short blonde styleless hair close against her head. And when I messaged Davina to sort of say, is this harsh? She said the word styleless is quite harsh. And this is an approximation of someone. This isn't actually like someone who really existed, but it's like they sort of did. And it's that thing of like you've got like a loophole when you're writing about someone where you can say it's like a cross-pollinated characterization, where it's like an amalgam of different people rather than just one individual. And Philip Roth was obviously, he excavated his own life a lot within his fiction, and there's some people that say, well, you know, I can migrate this experience, say, within a related context of a relationship, I can migrate it to the page because it's refracted through the prism of my own brain, my own perceptions. How I perceived an event. So it's not, I'm not saying it has total integrity as something with verisimilitude. Like, I'm not saying it is objective. I'm just saying that this is how what happened to me. It was a part of my life, and I've decided to put it into my fiction. And then other people will say, that's a fucking cop out. You've used a human being. You've used them. You've recycled a human being or the time you spent together with complete disregard for their feelings. As in your head, obviously, you're prioritizing the art over the person, which is, you know, it's not a nice thing to do. I think that's kind of cruel. But you negotiate with this in your head. You have to negotiate with this stuff a lot, and you have to negotiate between, like I said before, when it comes to writing jokes, you have to negotiate between the opportunity to make a joke, or you have to chuck away the opportunity to make a joke in order to just be a human being and not show up or shame someone else. What are you going to do? You're going to be a joke star, or are you going to actually have compassion for other human beings? I'm probably going to pick joke star. I'm probably going to say that one feels nice in the moment and feels, get that kind of giddy, transgressive taboo laughter you get from where, which is what this bit in the book was. So she's plump with pale skin and very short blonde hair close against her head. So I said I used the word styleless. Pavina thought stylus was harsh. I said, I don't know how else to say. I'm going to use a word. This was in a private conversation with my friend, but I think it actually, in the interest of full disclosure, I am going to say what the word was. So I said, I don't know how else to say she has hair like a spastic, though. Like it's short, spastic hair. So I thought I was being diplomatic with styleless. And I've realised, and so I've kind of kept this in the book because it's a bit of a self-indulgent meta commentary on what I say my like sado trickster side and then my compassionate caring side, and they both, you know, both coexist within me and in within a lot of people, I'm guessing, and, you know, myriad other selves. And how one will win out over the other, depending on the circumstance. I said, so I thought I was being diplomatic with Starless, and Davina, haha, oh my God, stop. Look, Starless is better than full on Spaz Lord. Obviously, she wasn't using that word. She was saying that I had used that word and like how ridiculous that was and offensive. And because she glares when, and this is back to the passage, and because she glares when you ask her a question as if she hasn't understood it properly, she reminds me of an overgrown baby. During a staff room chat, one of her many self-appointed breaks, which is a little bit passive-aggressive, she told me this delay is due to an almost paralysing social anxiety, further compounded by a lisp. So there's elements of this that are from an actual person, but not totally. And the other carers aren't very considerate. They'll mock her and her boyfriend, who is closer in age to the residents, and then conclude with, she's a sweet girl, though, as if that cancels out the cruelty. And then as a footnote, I said, it's a hairstyle I attribute to people who've been taken into care. The only basis for this is in senior school, there was a girl with the same short, uneven hair. She was so clearly disadvantaged, musty, moth-eaten clothes, carried everything in a plastic bag. I did this as well, to be fair, and had two mums, who were twin sisters. Her arm was often in plaster, or she limped in on crutches. Apparently the mums threw her down the stairs to claim injury compensation, which eventually forced her into care. Remember, this is information gleaned from like our senior school whisper network, so its veracity is questionable. This domestic worker has the same hair and what I perceive to be the same sadness. There's a quality that I can only describe as chewed up by mental health services. Chewed up like a short chewed up hair. Right, this will probably come out of the book, I think. This will probably come out of the book because you have to have responsibility, and I don't think it's worth, I don't think it's worth, especially as I talk in this chapter about curbing behaviors while also divorcing those behaviors of shame, stuff like coprophagia or you know, coprophilic behavior or shit sneering, these awkward realities of care home life, which I will actually talk about a little bit. But how do you convey, like, we just look at, like, so in this great book called The Politics of Down Syndrome by Kieran Smith, and he talks about an exchange he had with Frankie Boyle, where Frankie Boyle said they all look alike, don't they? They've all got the same hair. I said before, he was kind of put on the spot, and in the resultant whirlwind, there were many misunderstandings. That we had stood up and confronted that Boyle, which they hadn't, the parents. That we had run to the press, and a fair amount of total nonsense too, including that we had actually taken our five-year-old daughter to the gig. There was quite a divided response from the public, understandably, as many would know people with Down syndrome and find the jokes equally offensive. And many who believed we wanted to quash free speech and with Daily Mail readers who would be offended. And Carr, Jimmy Carr and Greaves, I can't remember her first name, they wrote a really good book about jokes. For an audience, the social rules are different and are further complicated by the fact that a great many of the individuals who take offence at a joke in a comedy show do so on behalf of a minority group of which they themselves are not a member. In fact, we were more disappointed and offended in a night out to face the same boring old prejudices about Down syndrome from a comedian who cites Noam Chomsky and George Mumbio as influences. I got into Chomsky because I heard Bill Hicks talk about him in an interview. Bill Hicks is my favourite comedian, really. That's a bit of a, there's a lot to mock at that. You know, the hero worship of Bill Hicks amongst comedians who, what Frankie Ball does is genuinely quite transgressive in some regards. The story had started to morph into something else entirely and had surprising longevity. 3 months after the incident, Julie Birchall wrote in the Times they were in an audience of Boyle's live show and they confirmed that they were previously fans of the scumbag, which pretty much made their complaint worthless. There are two fascinating aspects of this experience. Firstly, why did a comedian who, although offensive, professes to be progressive, wander so far from his path? And secondly, why did it get so much discussion and attention? The beginning of the skit around Down syndrome started when Boyle selected a person from the audience and asked him what they did. Being in Reading and near to the Microsoft campus, it was not a huge surprise that he had picked upon a Microsoft employee. At the time, the Windows 7 campaign was running with adverts extolling the benefits of the new operating system with the strap line of Windows 7 was my idea. Boyle's joke was that the ad in his program was a picture of someone with Down syndrome saying Windows 7 was his idea, adding for no apparent reason that he had to make sure he found a model that was also dead. Fucking there's a sort of middle class fear about Down syndrome, anxiety about community opinions, fear that the child will fail to achieve prescribed goals, as well as provide a pivot for whatever other family stresses are associated with middle class striving. There was so much of the stereotype in what was said. So it's a convenient shorthand, and unfortunately it's an identifiable shorthand if you're talking about people with Down syndrome having shit hair, and that it's actually born out of an outdated institutionalization where they were forced to have the same hair, have the same clothes, they were policed and to remain within prescribed social borders. And weirdly enough, ironically enough, the problem with that institutionalization is that they were forced into these sort of delineated borders and to not transgress social norms or social mores. They weren't allowed to be individuals. And so obviously Kieran Smith is going to be against that, having a child with Down syndrome. You can see that, you know, my beautiful child is, an individual. A beautiful child isn't just defined by having Down syndrome. There's a lot more to, I think she's a girl. Did I say a daughter? There's a lot more to her than just this syndrome. But then he's kind of forcing the same parameters onto Frankie Boyle and not giving Frankie Boyle the opportunity to transgress or, you know, test those boundaries. By the way, I'm saying this completely. This is contemporaneous, or is it extemporaneous? I never know which one. Off the cuff. This is the ill thought out. I there's probably about a million holes in my argument, which should be gaping holes that I recognize, but my brain doesn't work that quickly. It's extemporaneous. So yeah, I mean, I sympathize totally with the parents, but I suppose I sympathize with Frankie Boyle as well, because I've got that in me. Like, how do you write about, because you can't analyze every last thing you do, especially if you're writing something, because you just get bogged down in analysis or like cultural theory or whatever. So knowing that saying someone has spastic hair is like a convenient shorthand, but also acknowledging that it's offensive and outdated, but while people still recognize it as a shorthand, how do you get that across without offending anyone? I suppose you can't, can you? Look, I'll go into the whole thing of, like, with regards to, so in the care home, one of the most uncomfortable and disturbing disclosures you can make to a resident family member involves this childlike reversion to playing with feces, or in some cases, coprophagic behavior. And the coprophagic behavior. And initially I chose to tactfully omit these details when reporting to families, but other carers weren't as committed to basic decency. You'd have a carer going, so what we had, like, mum spent some time in the sunshine, play some games, a good day all round, wasn't it a good day all round, a lot of sunshine, a lot of games, really enjoying herself, resplendent. I don't know what it means either. Sometimes I just say words and you think, what does that mean? You know, it might be in the wrong context, who knows? But she was enjoying herself. She was luxuriating. That's the one we'll go for, isn't it? That's the one we'll go for, love, isn't it? You were luxuriating in the sunshine. Anyway, why have you? We did catch mum gobbling big handfuls of shite. Yeah, we caught her jumping on shite. Big fat handfuls of her own shit. So yeah, she is being careful there, because, you know, she understands infection control. She knows she's not been gobbling big fucking handfuls of other people's shit. So she has been caught gobbling big handfuls of her own shite. But yeah, lots of sunshine, lot of games. Anyway, take care, Hunt. Enjoy Tenerife. See you when you get back, love. Buy me something. Yeah, bring me something back nice. It didn't even make sense. Sometimes you say words, you don't even know what they mean, do you? Well, look, she's doing it now. Woo-hoo-wee! That stings, mama. Yeah, fucking really good. Scoffing it. Scoffing her own shite there. But I thought by leaving out the right, this is where, and I'll die on a hill for this. I thought by leaving out the grotesque parts of the job and the aberrant behaviour of these elders, I was being a decent person and demonstrating my moral rectitude. Like, what's the harm in curating their lives and selecting which moments to pass on to their loved ones? We all do that kind of thing. And eventually I had a change of heart. I realised denying a portion of their lived experience was actually doing them a disservice. This was happening, this awkward fact of care home life. And if we keep pussyfooting around it, it will remain underreported and cloaked in shame. And in those instances, I'd prioritised the wrong person, holding back to mollify the family member, preserve the uncorrupted image of Nana or Dad, etc., that they held in their heads. It also meant the family member wasn't inured to the vagaries of living with dementia. And if they caught a glimpse of the realities, unprepared, they might turn away and pretend it isn't happening. This denialism leads directly to deprivation and neglect, to a sanitized conception of demented behavior. As a result, they'd accuse us of being liars or blamed us for not adequately regulating the residents' actions. They reduce their visits as he doesn't want, even know if I'm here or not. That's what they'd say, which is a veiled way of saying I don't want to deal with this. I'm not proposing we normalise such conduct, this fixation on feces and urine, but within this context, we should normalise exposure to an adult's infantilised preoccupation with feces and urine. That's why in my stand-up, in my writing, I'm occasionally compelled to shove other people's noses in it. For progress. I don't want to seem as if I'm like disregarding the family members' feelings. I understand the reasons people want us as carers to withhold this information and their reluctance to confront it head on. And I respect their wishes, but I hope they'll try to overcome their natural squeamishness. It's in their relatives' best interest to help them curb this behaviour while also divorcing it from shame. And more to the point, we all have a social responsibility to reject any dehumanising applications that may lead to demographics being shunned. As Carolyn Kortsmeyer writes in this book, Savouring Disgust, The Foul and the Fair in Aesthetics, disgust is an effective response that can be mustered to patrol the social boundaries and norms. For instance, to reinforce prescriptions on what should be eaten or in our sexual behaviour. I mean, preferably people shouldn't be eating shite. But you can see how expressing disgust or stigmatising these actions has the potential to lead to the mass ostracisation, of people with mental illness. So to take ownership of my own missteps, describing a person's short, chewed-up hair has a similar effect. I'm squeezing people with mental illness into a single identity. And then, as with the girl from senior school and the domestic worker, they're othered by their peers and their colleagues. So, I'm just as guilty of that shit. I think I'll wrap it up there for the moment. Trying to keep them shorter, and I don't feel very well. But yeah, savelivecomedy.co.uk. Get over there, hand them some of your bunts, and help keep comedy alive. Love you all, and see you next week.